The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on December 8, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, today's the day. Do you know that? Today's Rohatsu.
Today is
Rohatsu. It literally translates as the eighth day of the 12th month. Yeah. And that's Japanese. And, you know, it's also known as Bodhi Day. And, it's when we celebrate the enlightenment of Buddha. That's why we do Rohatsu Sessions. Traditionally, Rohatsu Sessions go from the 1st of December to the 8th of December in honor of Buddha's 7 days of sitting. And then it ends on, you know, the 8th. And we, as an urban center, trying not to cause too much grief for people who have jobs, we try to move it so that it's not a full week long. So at its fullest, our Rohatsu session is 5 days. And then here's something that you should be thankful you aren't doing, because you know what they do on the sixth night of a Rohatsu session? They meditate all night long. So there's no sleep from the 7th to the 8th. And I guess Katagiri did that with his students kind of as a surprise. He said, hey, let's stay up. Let's keep meditating. We were like, So, but yeah, that's today's Bodhi Day. So put in an extra effort today for Buddha. All right. Well, my talk today is a chapter in this book titled True Freedom. And, you know, I like to sit, park myself on those titles for a while and look at them. I don't know if you do that when you read, you know, kind of look at a title and ponder what it means to you before you really start reading a book. Sometimes I do it, sometimes I don't. I just finished reading or rereading recently Franz Kafka's The Trial. And I hadn't really thought about the title, because it's the trial. Everybody knows the trial. Do you know what I mean? So I just didn't really think about it. I finished reading the book and I went, wait, there wasn't a trial in the book. Or there was a trial, but what kind of trial was it? Do you know what I mean? Like, it was so thinking about, I wish I would have thought about the title a little more before I read it, because it's interesting. So when I look at this title, it's one of those titles, you just, True Freedom, you go, you know, I don't know, it just kind of, it doesn't catch your eye. That last one had that word sprout that, you know, at least stopped me. I'm just like, you don't see that word too often, especially with, you know, in the context that we're seeing in it. But True Freedom, you look at that and you just go, well, freedom, check. Check. And True Freedom might be, I don't know, really good freedom. And then you just kind of move on. But one thing to remember about, you know, maybe when you think about what writer you're reading can be helpful, but Steve is not one to dollop out the adjectives. So his writing is pretty free of adjectives and adverbs. It's not that they're not there, but he's really careful about not overdoing it with that stuff. So when he says true freedom, that true means something. And so then you get to pause and go, okay, well, so, because true freedom in some ways it just feels like it's excess, right? True freedom. I mean, if it's not freedom, then it's not freedom. It doesn't really seem to need the true attached to it. So why is that true there? So then you go, well, there must be a true, not true freedom that's opposed to this, right? Some sense of freedom perhaps that's opposed to this idea of true freedom. Or maybe even that somehow true is free. That one seems to be a little far-fetched, right? That true might be free. Though I don't think it's exactly wrong either. You know, there's something in there. So I thought I'd just look at some other definitions of true, just to kind of see what it's telling us. And of course, one is in accordance with fact or reality, and that's probably the way we think of true as being true. But then there's this one that we might know from a different context, which is to bring an object into the exact shape, alignment, or position required. And that seems to me to be pretty suggestive, especially when you bring it together with the first meaning. So I kind of squashed the two together and came up with something like, in accordance with fact or reality, that is exactly as required. Exactly. Right. And then I immediately, when I did that, I went, oh, it reminds me of that koan. It's a very brief koan. You know this one? It features Yunmin. He's the master. A monk asked Yunmin, what are the teachings of a whole lifetime? And Yunmin said, an appropriate statement. The teachings of a whole lifestyle. That's what is exactly required. An appropriate statement. It is in accordance with fact or reality. So that's our title, right? So that's kind of the ground that's being laid for us by this title, I think. So Steve starts out, he says, another Chinese teacher, and I thought it was interesting he did that, because, you know, I was reading the chapters together, so I knew what that was a reference to, but he's actually referring to his previous chapter, and you may remember the previous chapter, he referred to Fuyan. So he starts out Fuyan, an ancient Chinese teacher. So here he goes, another Chinese teacher from ancient times, Ying An, told his students, when you pass through, no one can pin you down, no one can call you back. We might get the idea from this that in Zen, there's some barrier, some goal, some threshold you must come up to and then cross over or pass through. And once you get through, the wonderful, delicious freedom of enlightenment is yours. At that point, you've made it. You're happy and serene. You're untouchable and invincible. Nobody can tell you what to do, and no one can call you back. You're really free. But if we look at what Ying An said in this way, we don't understand him at all. In fact, we're dead wrong on all counts. This misunderstanding comes from using our ordinary ego-centered perspective, which is precisely what Ying An is helping us to drop. So, you know, when we do encounter a teaching like Ying An's, you know, where he tells us, when you pass through, no one can pin you down, no one can call you back. It does kind of have this flavor to it. You think there's this barrier that you're coming to, you break through. Well, he says pass through. But it feels like you got to get through it somehow. You know, it's like when I first encountered the image of the gateless gate. I don't know about you, but I tried to picture that. So I was like going, okay, so what is that? And somebody was talking about, well, think of it as like a wall, and you're going along this wall, and there's really no entrance to it, but you can get through the wall or whatever it was. And I was trying to picture what that was like, you know. So this barrier, there's something about this barrier. Anyhow, we get this idea. There's a barrier, there's a gate, and then you have to try to picture it. If it's a gateless gate, what does this look like, right? And then you think, well, tend to go through it. Once you pass through it, then no one can pin you down. No one can call you back. Well, that sounds pretty great. It sounds like you are your own person then. You are free. Now, I heard on a podcast the other day, I heard a guy who was a free speech lawyer, a free speech advocate, we can say. And he loves freedom so much. He loves freedom so much that he actually detests going to sporting events because they kind of coerce him to root for a team. That's how much he loves freedom. He doesn't like to be told what to do. He doesn't like to be told what to say. He doesn't like other people to be told what to do or say either. He demands autonomy, or he expects it. And perhaps he's passed through. I don't know. But he sure thinks that most of us are bound up. That is definitely the impression I got listening to this guy. But that's not, at least what Steve tells us, that's not what Ying An is talking about. Because that kind of freedom, just think about that, going to a sporting event. Now, I hate to say I know what the guy's talking about, because I've been there. I've been where this guy's talking about. But imagine going to a sporting event, and everyone's rooting on the team, and you're like irritated. You feel oppressed because you don't, just because everybody's doing it. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't, you know, I was at a show I was at a show. It was called Arsenic and Old Lace, which is kind of a well-known comedy. And when it was done, the audience sprang to their feet. And I will say it was very professionally performed. And I'm happy to say that this is when I lived in Milwaukee. I used to go to a place called the Milwaukee Rep. Todd and I are favorite actor. And he wasn't like the best actor. There was just something about him. We really liked him. We enjoyed watching him. We see him on TV now. He's made it in Hollywood. I mean, he doesn't have like starring roles, but he comes on and we go, oh, it's Tori Hansen, you know. So Tori was in this production. So it was a good production of Arsenic and Old Lace, but it was Arsenic and Old Lace, and everybody sprang to their feet, and I was just like, I'm not going to. So I know what this guy's talking about, but there's something really ego-driven about it, right? That nobody's going to tell me what to do. This is all about my freedom, my ability to do whatever I want. This is about me stepping through that, you know, barrier. I pass through and I am free. I'm not like you people, you know. And then when I was thinking about that, I thought, well, there's actually and I don't know where this story comes from, because it can't be the way that anybody legitimately looks at this. But I've heard it before. And maybe story is the wrong way to put it. Maybe interpretation is the right way to put it. And again, I'm not saying this is the way Mahayana views it. It's just, it was presented to me this way at one point, and I was going, that doesn't make any sense. What you're saying, Mahayana Buddhism looks at non-Mahayana Buddhism, and particularly they might have been talking about Theravadan Buddhism, and they look at the figure of the arhat as being egocentric, because the arhat is working on getting enlightened. They're working on entering nirvana, right? So what they do is first they become a stream enterer, right? And then maybe a couple lifetimes later they become a once returner. And then that means one more life. And then if they get it right the next time, then they're a non-returner. And then the last time they're an arhat and off they go to nirvana. And then it's, you know, the way it's portrayed is a lot like the way that Jed said that he didn't think Avalokiteshvara was after attaining unsurpassed perfect enlightenment, saying, well, I got mine, now you guys are on your own, you know. But that's the way that it's portrayed, and that, so then the Mahayana, they instead revere the figure of the Bodhisattva, who just before entering Nirvana steps back and remains here. And I remember a friend of mine was talking to a Tibetan teacher, in Tibet. So he was over there and he was talking to a Tibetan teacher. He was telling him that story and the Tibetan teacher started laughing and laughing. He goes, that doesn't make any sense. You know, the idea about stepping back before entering nirvana. But that's again, it really what that story I think is helping us to see is that when our practice is ego driven, it's off the mark. You know what I mean? It misses the mark. Like Jed was saying about Avalokiteshvara, like if an arhat is waking up and having unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment, if they're entering nirvana, it can't be egocentric. Do you know what I mean? It's at odds with it. It just doesn't work that way. But we can take up this practice and think we're doing this, right? We think there's a kind of freedom. We'll chase after this freedom. Now, if you actually take up practice that way, practice will be frustrating. It'll actually be impossible. I can't imagine anybody for whom, you know, if they think they're going to get to the barrier and then pass on through at some point, who's going to be satisfied with this practice. And it may be where you start, but you just can't hang on to it. You know, it becomes difficult. It's like, because you just realize that, well, when is this going to happen? You know, you keep waiting for it to happen. It's like, when I used to carry a baritone horn, which is sort of like a mini tuba. That was my instrument when I was a high school student and even when I was in college. And the high school was about a mile walk. Yeah, a mile, a little bit longer, a mile maybe from my house. So you're talking maybe 20-minute walk carrying this baritone horn. And I will say, by the end, you know, first you carry it in one hand for a while, and you're carrying it for a while, and then after a while you go, ah, I can't carry it in that hand anymore, and then you switch to the other hand, and then you carry it in that hand for a while, and ah, I can't carry it, and suddenly you're switching so often, do you know what I mean? And it never feels like that. And if there were no end in sight, I think you'd just put the horn down. And I think that's the way with this practice too, right? If you're going for the egocentric, I'm going to be free, You know, I'm going to break through. It's all going to be about me being free. You just won't be able to carry the horn anymore. At some point, you're just going to set it down, and you're just going to go on and go to your football games and, you know, either cheer with your team or be aggravated that everyone around you is cheering for your team. But what Ying An is describing is not bound to ego, and it's not about getting to some point where you've made it. And this is really important, right, because this practice isn't about you've made it. You're there. You've made the goal, right? This practice is about living every moment of our life and engaging and fully living every moment of our life. And in fact, as Steve points out, this ego-driven idea of I'm going to get there at some point and be free is exactly what Ying An is actually helping us to see we need to drop. We need to drop that conception of life and of practice. Steve says we're very confused about this issue of freedom. We think it means something like I can do what I want. No one can tell me what to do. There are no restrictions anymore. It's totally up to me. But notice that there's an adolescent ring to such thoughts. I once saw several teenagers interviewed on a TV report about marketing tobacco to youth. A reporter asked the group of teenagers, "Are you smoking because your parents don't approve of it?" Several of them said yes, and one added, "They tell us not to do something, man, and we're going to do it." To many of us as grown-ups, this remains our idea of freedom, though we might express it in regard to religion, career, or civic duties. But from a Buddhist perspective, "you can't tell me what to do" is an expression of bondage, not freedom. So yeah, there's no doubt about it. This "you can't tell me what to do, I can do whatever I want to." I think we recognize this. This is not like, Steve's not making this up, right? This is very much a part of the American character. I hear this kind of thing expressed all the time, and it does have an adolescent ring to it. It really, truly does. And you know, it's, to me, to my ear, it's what I was hearing in what that free speech advocate was saying. Now, I'm not here to cut him down, because some of what he was saying was actually fairly complex and was interesting, you know, but there were just elements of it that just smacked of like listening to an adolescent, but he was 40 years old or 50 years, however old he was, you know. And I was hearing that not only in what he said about the sporting event, but even what he said about free speech, which he seemed to link freedom with saying whatever's on your mind. That's what I heard him saying anyhow, that he was linking freedom with saying whatever's on your mind. Which is another version of I can do whatever I like. Whatever I like, that, and I should be allowed to do that. Right? That's the ultimate, the pinnacle of freedom. And again, I recognize this, right? I certainly, when I was younger, I thought, you gotta say what you gotta say. Do you know what I mean? And sometimes people ain't gonna like to hear it, but truth ain't pretty. You know, and I would say this stuff and I would be contrary and I'd be like, well, I'll tell you right now, I have no idea about any kind of sport whatsoever. I mean, very little. And I do because I grew up in an area where sports were revered as some kind of religious object. I mean, seriously, it was punitive if you weren't interested or capable of doing sports. And so I just went, screw all of you. And I just completely turned my back on sports for my whole, and it's just been effective my whole life. Cause once you turn that stuff off, you don't really have to engage with it. You know what I mean? A lot of people around me are, and I have no idea what they're talking about. I'm never quite sure when things are happening. You know, it's like, well, did the World Series happen? Or I mean, sometimes if I'm paying attention to the news and it's on there, I know, but otherwise I don't really know. And I don't really care that much. But back then I did care. And that's how I got to this place. And when I was a young man, I was doing the same thing. I was just telling people the truth. You know, and some of it was maybe, you know, the reason I was doing it was driven by painful reasons. You know, this, I'm not going to be, because I think about that and I suffered from that. You know, I certainly alienated people. I got threatened by people a number of times, strangers. They weren't even, I wasn't even talking to them. I was talking to my friends. I had a guy fling a cigarette at me once. I had another guy tell me he was going to slit my throat and dump me in a gutter. I had another guy, you know what I mean? Like, But I was just talking to friends. Do you know what I mean? No, that would have been in Wisconsin. This was here in Minneapolis. Oh. Yeah. So maybe I said something about Fran Tarkington. I don't know. But anyhow, so I know that, you know, and I did, first of all, it really was a position from which some joy was derived, but so was some suffering. You know what I mean? And I think the joy came from dukkha. You know, it really was dukkha. And you know, it was a lifetime of sort of starting to learn about that, about what I was doing and why I was doing it. So the thing I came to realize is that was more of an idea of freedom than it really was freedom. So we think about before ideas sprout, you know, the talk from a couple days ago, same sort of thing. I realized it was just an idea. And as Steve says, an expression of bondage. Because really what you end up doing is if you're a contrarian, you're completely tied up with the thing you're contrary to. You know what I mean? That's as much a part of what you're doing as, even if what you're doing is completely not that thing, it still contains that thing, right? You can't get rid of that. But Steve goes on to tell us how it is that what Yingan is pointing out is not that kind of freedom. He says, because the Buddha said, what I call liberation, the world calls resignation. Now, how does that make you want to, like, go, yeah, I want that kind of liberation, right? Because the Buddha said that, Steve says, some people view Buddhism as giving in to or giving up something, as if these teachings recommend that we lie down like a doormat rather than stand up and face reality. People suffering from this form of delusion may say, all those forces out there are immense. Stop trying to fight them. Just surrender yourself totally. Then you'll experience enlightenment or freedom. But this is not at all what the Buddha spoke of as liberation. In fact, this very thinking is bondage itself. It's still our ordinary, self-oriented state of mind. The reason the Buddha's message sounds like resignation to us is because we still presume a self here and something else out there. But the Buddha pointed out that there isn't any world out there apart from you. That is, true separation between you and other things simply cannot be found. And I just want to pause because that little word true got in there again. True separation between you and others cannot simply be found. Liberation comes not from knuckling under to the rules of the universe, but from seeing that there's no separate person to give in and no separate overwhelming universe to give in to. Right? So again, Buddha says what I call liberation, the world calls resignation. Now, I'm not sure of that quote. Like, I don't know the source of that. Do you know the source of that? Yeah, so I looked it up. And as is the case when you're reading Steve Hagen's books, you'll often get Steve Hagen's version of it. He's got a way of paraphrasing, of sort of rewording things into English that people really like. So when you start looking up, you know, Steve will say a Zen teacher, and you're trying to find the actual koan, you keep getting Steve's books because the way he put it is so uniquely Steve, right? So the Buddha probably put it slightly differently than that, I'm guessing, because I couldn't find anything that didn't refer back to this book. And beware, too, when something like that, Steve's got like the perfect quote, and you're seeing it as a meme or something like that, because it's probably actually Steve. They'll say the Buddha, but it's going to be Steve's version of it. So just be really careful of that. You know, I learned this just by trying to find sources of some of the things you talked about. And then just as another warning, then I've asked Steve, I really like that quote. Yeah, I was trying to find the source to it. What was it? I don't remember. I think it's something Katagiri said, right? And then you're like, okay. So I don't really know what the quote is, but just judging by the context of it, it looks like this has to do with, you know, what I call liberation, the world calls resignation. It has something to do with that self giving up, that ego self that we have, and along with it, will, right?
Will.
The will to go out and do stuff in the world. So it sounds like we're giving up the self and the thing, the engine that drives the self, which is will or intention, right? The desire to change the world. And I say that probably because, like I said, the context that Steve is presenting this in. Because right after he talks about that quote, he says that people interpret this as lying down like a doormat rather than standing up to reality, and that if you just stop fighting with these immense forces and surrender yourself totally, then you'll experience enlightenment or freedom, right? So that's what people hear in the Buddhist teaching, that particular teaching. But as Steve points out, the only reason that we hear resignation in there, the only reason it sounds like we're giving up, that that's the whole point of it, is because we're hanging on to that self to begin with. So we think that there's a self there that we're being asked to get rid of. And this is very common. I hear it from people when they come to this practice. In fact, some people are leery of Buddhism because they think that's what it's asking you to do, is give up yourself. And we value that little bugger. We value ourself. It's, you know, it's what gives us all our pleasure. It's what gives us all our woes. At least that's what we think. So to imagine what it would be like without that. Again, it just sounds like, again, and with intention put in there as well, it sounds like quiescence, right? It sounds like we're being asked to lie down and let the universe trample all over us. And again, what Steve points out is not only is the problem that we already are buying into the sense of self, but as soon as we do that, that creates that world out there, right? The world out there is tied in to the sense of self. And I remember this being pointed out pretty vividly in a teaching I encountered in graduate school. So I didn't study psychology when I was an undergraduate. I don't think I took any classes. The intro to psych class at the U was one of these things where they had like 1,100 students in it, and they had TV monitors. And I was like, why would I want to do that? That doesn't sound like a class. I could just read the books on my own. But in that, but what I encountered in graduate school was Jacques Lacan's mirror stage, where a child learns. And I think of this more as a metaphor. I don't know how literally he meant this to be, because he gives you a particular age where a child starts doing this. They start seeing themselves in a mirror, and they start conceiving themselves as being a unified, separate individual self, right? As a child. And once they do that, then they start to, then there's this world out there that before that, things are, they have less boundaries to them, right? They're a little smooshy. And even after you start creating those boundaries, they can still be kind of smooshy, which I discovered when I was playing with a friend of mine's nephew, and I was pretending to be a bear, and I ended up scaring the hell out of him. You know, and I said, whoa, I was just playing. It's okay. Interestingly enough, the kid's name is Bjorn, which is Norwegian for bear. Yeah, I really scared him, and I had to make sure he knew I was just me. I wasn't a bear. Because those boundaries are a little porous yet, even when we start to develop them. But we do develop them. And they are related. Once there's a sense of me, there's a world out there. And it usually comes with me first. Separating that me. And parents are also showing us stuff. Tree, dog, right? So we're also starting to get a world constructed for us as well. But those two come together, and that world that's out there often seems to be at odds with us, right? We seem to struggle with it. So what we're actually being asked to do, right? Or what we think we're being asked to do, to give up that self that's separate from the rest of the world and then give in to those forces that are outside of us. But as Steve points out, the Buddha taught that there actually is no out there, no world out there, right? That, as Steve said, true separation can't be found. And I think he says true separation there, just like he does with true freedom, because there's boatloads of separation. You know what I mean? Like, when we look at appearances, it's just, that's all it is, separation. So it's like I was talking about with the continuous flux and flow of reality, is that it's hard for us to see it because it looks like there are things that just don't look like they're fluxing and flowing, right? Same thing with separation. It looks like there's separation. It looks like Andrew and I aren't squished together, right? Which, when I first heard of becoming one with, I thought it was something, like, I couldn't quite figure out what people were trying to tell me. So I remember when I was having problems ringing the bell, and I remember this one guy saying, don't you just become one with the bell? And I remember going, Oh my God, what a weird thing to say. I said, of course I don't feel like I'm one with the bell. That's partly why I'm having problems ringing it. You know what I mean? But what does it mean to be one with the bell? It sounded like if you remember that TV show Kung Fu, older people would remember. Have you heard of that show, Kung Fu? Have you heard of that show, Kung Fu? Yeah. Yeah. Have you heard of the show? See, you can see I'm a certain age. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like this fugitive. I'm not going to go into the story too much, but he was like a fugitive, and was he Japanese or Chinese?
Chinese.
I think they always called him Chinese, but I thought that was part of the American thing where if you were Asian, they just called you Chinese, you know. But anyhow, it was in the old West times, you know, and this guy knew Kung Fu, but then every once in a while, he'd have flashbacks to when he was a child. And I don't know who that guy was, you know, like he must have been his martial arts teacher or whatever, but he spoke like a guru or whatever. So he'd say these cryptic phrases and that's what becoming one with the bell just sounds like, something that you'd hear on Kung Fu in the flashback with the Zen master. You do not have a pebble in your hand, you know, that kind of thing, where you're just like, you know, so becoming one with. We can see, I mean, that doesn't make sense to us just at a real immediate sense. There seems to be boatloads of separation, so it's hard for us, right, to think, so what are you telling me? I have to give up the sense that there's a world out there? Because it sure looks like there's a world out there. This whole idea about a world outside is addressed. So when I was preparing this talk, I realized there were several koans that seemed to be alluded to, or that at least seemed to be informative to this talk, one of which was, you know, just from the title that I've already spoke. But this one, maybe you know this one. It's another pretty well-known one, Jing King's Sound of Raindrops. So a student asked, Jing King starts this out. So it's a student, a monk, and Jing King is a Zen master. And Jing King asked a monk, what is that sound outside the gate? And the monk said, the sound of raindrops. Jing King said, sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things. And the monk said, what about you, teacher? And Jing King said, I almost don't lose myself. And the monk said, what is the meaning of I almost don't lose myself? Jing King said, though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult, right? So I think of that when I think about this idea of world out there and world in here and, you know, what it is that's going on. Because that the master, when he's asking that monk, what is the sound outside the gate? Now that's interesting because the gate, I already mentioned the gateless gate. So what is that gate exactly that he's talking about? Yeah, Andrew.
Like, do you think maybe when you're kind of approaching that gateless gate idea, what you're actually bumping up against is realizing that there's really no self to even let go of to begin with.
That there's what?
There's no self to let go of to begin with.
Yeah.
Like you realize, oh shit, now what? You know what I mean?
I think ultimately that's it, yeah, but I think at first that sounds like...
Well, but yeah. Like, you know, when you were talking about people have that feeling of, oh, I'm afraid of Buddhism because yeah. I'm going to have to give up myself and yeah. Like, we want to hang on to the self. Yeah. But then it almost kind of feels like perhaps what it's suggesting is more like as you practice, you suddenly realize there's nothing even there to begin with. That
yeah.
Self,
I think so.
Is just illusionary.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I thought that's what you were saying you start out with, because I have a feeling that's even true. Do you know what I mean? Even when you think you're being asked to give up that self and it seems like something precious, I feel like, especially if you're looking at Buddhism, if you've gotten yourself to that place, odds are you've already started to see some incoherence in that. I did. You know, again, I spent a lot of time just being a bozo in my life and learning things very slowly. But I remember just seeing that myself was pretty incoherent. Not in a way that I thought, I didn't even really think about the self. And so again, when I was going to graduate school, I started reading these theorists who were postmodernist theorists. And You know, the first guy I was reading was saying there was no coherent individual self. And he was like explaining a very difficult language. It was like reading another, it was like reading another language that was translated into English. And I couldn't quite understand what he was saying, but that part I understood. And it was mind blowing because I went, oh, well, that makes sense. And then I started thinking a little bit about what little I knew about Freud, because again, I hadn't studied psychology, but I watched a lot of Woody Allen movies. So Freud was referred to a lot. And, you know, and I understood then. I just went, oh, this is Freud's ego, id, and super ego, right? They're just an ununified self. Really, that's like one way, it's just in a general way that you could describe it. Whether or not you buy into any of that other stuff, you can see that Freud was aware of the fact that the self is not unified, right? So that's what I thought you were saying. When you start, you actually even have an inkling because you taste, because you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I think
you start to realize what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that there's a possibility of seeing that what you thought was this big important thing wasn't even there to begin with. There was something kind of going, well, then where did all this grief come from? You know, what did I lead on to?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that to me is what I suspect and what I've maybe pondered, that that's what that thing is that you're bumping up against. That's that gateless gate. Like, you're not really crossing anything in particular. It's just more of this awareness of, wow, this whole big show I put together of me doesn't really hold on. It just kind of isn't really that solid.
Yeah. Well, the gate is how you're seeing.
Yeah.
Right, so that's what it is. So the way I was thinking, there's a gate out there and you need to find it or see it. But the gate, the reason it's a gateless gate is there's not really a gate there, but it's like there's a gate there.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's absolutely right. So yeah, when he says gate, you know, what is he talking about? And then the student, however the student interprets it, you know, it could be very literally, but he could also still be talking about the gates of the senses, or I'm not really sure, because gate is kind of a, you know, a smooshy word. But he says the sound of raindrops. So then you can see that outside the gate, there's a world. At least you can see that's the construction that the student's coming up with. So then Jin Ching says, sentient beings are inverted. And this is very important. That inversion, once I started understanding that, how we just flip this all backwards or upside down. This is what we do. And he goes, we're inverted. We lose ourselves and then follow after things, right? And that losing ourselves and following after things, that's what we do, right? We lose track of our true self, what we really are, which is, I think, Andrew, what you were talking about. That self isn't really there, that little self that we're building, that we're something else. And you could say you're something, I remember Cal Appleby used to say, you're bigger than you imagine you are. And that's a very coarse way of putting it. But it's on the right track. Do you know what I mean? Because this whole universe has shown up as you, man. Do you know what I mean? Like, so when Jin Ching is talking about this, what we do is we lose track of that. We lose ourselves. And because of that, then we feel like something's missing. So we go follow after things to try either to find that self. Holy cow, go to a self-help section. Seriously, and I remember when my husband was struggling yet again with what career he was going to pursue. He never really quite figured that one out. But several times in his life, you know, he's like, oh, I don't know what to do. And, you know, he took courses on trying to find it. What color is your parachute? I remember he had that book. And, you know, so he had, you know, he was doing stuff to try to figure all this out. Took that. Whose inventory is that? Which one is it? Is that what it is with the intuitive and the, yeah. I've had to take that thing like 4 or 5 times. And the first time I took it, because I was contrarian, I just thought, well, this looks like a load of crap. So what I'm going to do is, I don't remember the letters, if you had to do A through D, but I just made patterns. I just went A through D. And it was interesting because I was clustered right in the middle of all the... And then, you know, and then to think that our management was somehow going to use that in some meaningful way. I'm just like, you interact with me every day, so you know who I am. You don't need a graph to tell you who I am, and I don't need a graph to tell me who I am. And to be honest, a graph wouldn't have told me any more than I thought I knew, which wasn't a lot. Do you know what I mean? I thought I knew who I was, but I certainly was wrong. So that's the thing. We lose ourselves and then follow after things. And like I said, sometimes that thing we're looking for is a self. And to be honest, it's really kind of always what we're looking for, but we might just think it's that thing that'll fill up the self-shaped hole that we feel. You know, we feel like something is missing. And so we take up falconry. I don't know why falconry came into my mind, but you take up some kind of hobby or something like that, or you buy a sports car. I remember I had this one friend who was a fairly unhappy person, you know, when I knew him in college. I mean, he's a sweet guy, but he was often just unhappy and searching. And when he finally got, he became a coder back in the days when that really paid a lot of money. And the first thing he did is he bought a hot, spanking new sports car, just a really expensive sports car. He was no happier than he was before, just a week before, but he had a brand new sports car now. So we do that, you know, we lose sight of our true self. We lose ourself and then we follow after things. And we could be pleasing ourselves, or we could be trying to repair ourselves, whatever it is, because we feel that something is missing. But what's interesting here is what Jin King says, which is, so as we're busy doing that, Jin King saying, well, you know, this is, does take effort, right? He says, I almost don't lose myself. So, well, I'll come back to these selves just in a second. I wrote down a sentence I'm so happy with, I'm going to read it out loud to you, though it'll be hard to follow, actually. But these selves can be a little hard to track, right? He says, I almost don't lose myself, and to say the whole thing has to be difficult. The whole thing. So again, thinking about... And I know I'm going to be talking about this at some point, so I don't want to get into it too far, but I'll just at least touch on this idea right now, that the reason that it's so difficult for us, again, is just because of seemingly how obvious our interpretation of it is, right? We have appearances and we interpret it, and that seems to be the obvious thing. So this other thing requires a little bit of effort. What it's really requiring us to do is not catch hold of those ideas. And that's so fast. So it's asking us to like catch an arrow in mid-flight. Do you know what I mean? It's like that fast. Or what is the image from the merging of difference and unity, the arrow tips meeting? You know, that's what we're really trying to do by catching ourselves grasping in a way. You know, it's that. It takes that much effort. And yet it doesn't take effort. The effort that it takes is just seeing when you're starting to make something, right? When ideas sprout. It's seeing the ideas sprouting, and then what do you do there? So the Buddhist teaching is not talking about buckling under or caving to the cruel demands of the universe. And here's the sentence. It's about losing yourself by not losing yourself, which you'll only get if you see what that self is, whichever one. It's about losing yourself by not losing yourself, which you'll only get if you see what that self is, whichever one. Whichever one. Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I think that koan is helping us to see. And I'll be bringing up a more well-known nesting of selves in a little bit in my talk here. So you still pondering that one, Cindy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the whichever one's probably throwing you. But it has to do with those two selves. So even when we're talking about Jin King said, when he says, well, we lose ourselves. Well, what self are we talking about? I already filled in the blanks and said true self. But when he says, I almost don't lose myself, I don't think he's talking about that self. I think he's talking about that self, ego self. And he almost doesn't lose that every day because it's so compelling for us. It takes that effort for us not to lose the true self, but to lose ego self, which is only lost because we realize it's not there. In other words, we're not really losing it. It's what Dogen refers to it as dropping off of body and mind and the body and minds of others. Same sort of thing. You know, it's a similar idea. So as Steve continues, he says, what the Buddha is talking about is the experience you're having right now. If you look at it for a moment, you'll see it's immediate, continuous, and inseparable from something else out there. You see and hear a car through the window and you think, a car is out there on the street. But where is the sound? Is it out there on the street? Is it in your ear? Is it in your brain? Is it in the vibration of the air between you here and the street out there? Where are all these events taking place? Most of us think there's something out there and I'm in here. I am separate from all that out there. Precisely because we think in this way, we're jerked around by the world, or more accurately, by our thoughts and feelings about it. These place us and keep us in bondage. So, you know, get back to this, you know, what Steve's saying at first is what the Buddha's talking about is experience you're having right now. If you look at it for a moment, you'll see it's immediate, continuous, and inseparable by something else that's out there. And, but we see and hear a car through the window. And that's actually that's the deal is we see and hear a car through the window, and it's so compelling the way that we've constructed what's going on then, which is that there's a car out there. And I'll just tell you right now that you can thwart these things pretty easily. You know, I remember when, I got my ear surgery for my now better, but still not so great hearing ear. I hadn't been able to hear out of that ear. I didn't know for how long. The way I discovered I couldn't hear was an alarm had been going off. A little alarm on, you know, had been going off and I didn't know it. And my husband was sitting there pushing me. And finally I rolled over and then I heard the alarm and I went, oh my God. And I flipped over again. I couldn't hear the alarm and I flipped over and I could hear the alarm and I flipped over and I went, oh, this can't be good. So when I finally got surgery for it, I could start to hear things I couldn't hear before. Something like just like a clock ticking, which I hadn't been able to hear before. And that was the thing. I heard a clock ticking and I started looking around and the person said, do you hear a clock ticking? I said, dude, I said, it's right over there. You know, I could hear things. And I remember being in the kitchen with my husband and I heard this noise and we were talking and I said, what was that noise? And he went, what noise? Well, there was just a noise. And he said, what are you talking about? He goes, just like 2 seconds ago, there was a noise. He goes, oh, you mean the car that drove by outside? Right. So we have to learn these things. We have to learn. For me, it was just a sound and it was a weird sound. And so I needed to have it identified because it was a sound I hadn't heard in a long time, you know. But then I learned and I'm still not great at it. I still will ask my husband for things like, is that a dog barking? And then he goes, it's kids talking out in the street. So it doesn't always register. But, and that's what I'm talking about. You know, so we get this idea of what's going on. I'm hearing sounds and then it's kids outside on the street. So that stuff is so compelling that what the Buddha's talking about, right? With the fact that this is an immediate, continuous and inseparable. This experience is, there's no separation, is that this stuff is so subtle. It's so easy to overlook. And one of the reasons why is it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. It's actually happening right now. And we just overlook it, this inseparableness. This is just what's going on. So we overlook it just because I think we think when we encounter these teachings, it's going to, like, when it hits, it's going to be like, whoa, inseparable, man. And maybe it will when you first see it. Kind of thing about Andrew was talking about before is realizing the fact that the self isn't this separate individual thing, right? When you first realize it, there might be some kind of response and it might be, or whatever, you know, but when you start to get used to it and you see it, it's just always there. It's just so mundane that we overlook it. Which is why, remember the other day I said that a lot of times when people hear these teachings, they're being asked to see reality different than it is. I remember somebody asking basically this question. And either asked Steve or Norm, I don't remember. If the world is the way the Buddha says it is, why isn't it just obvious? You know, that's the way it really is. Why isn't it just obvious? But the thing is, it is. It actually is obvious. it's taking place right now. You know, what it's like is, and I think Steve has talked about this before as well, but have you read Edgar Allan Poe's The Purloined Letter? Did I look around? Anyone read that story? The Purloined Letter? So, you know, it's one of Poe's famous, it might have been the first detective story. It was one of them. He invented the detective story, Edgar Allan Poe did. And so what happened was there was a letter, very valuable letter, and someone stole it. And so the police were searching all over this apartment looking for it. And there was a letter in the apartment. It was just sort of sitting out. I don't remember how they understood that letter, but I'm saying this because it actually, as you're reading the Poe story, there is a letter in there, you know, and it's just the blah, blah, blah letter, you know. And so they're looking all over for this hidden letter, and they can't find it, you know, to save their lives. And then the guy who was the template for Sherlock Holmes, I don't remember his name. Did you read these stories at all? No. He's got a French name. Anyhow, he...
Inspector Clouseau.
I love Inspector Clouseau, but not Inspector Clouseau. I don't remember his name right now. But he comes into the room, and he immediately sees that the letter that's sitting out is the letter that they've been hunting for. Do you know what I mean? And Poe's point is that what's right out there for us to see, that's the stuff we overlook. And we'll look to the farthest corners of the universe trying to find the thing that's right there in front of us, right? And that's why this seems not obvious. Is it so obvious? It's like the nose on your face, you know? It's just, it's right there. So, but we have to make an effort only because I'd say it's obvious, but there's stuff that's constantly distracting us. It's not distracting us, but we're distracted. You know, because it's not the stuff's fault. It's not distracting us. There's just stuff appearing. It comes and it goes. It comes and it goes. That's the nature of this reality. Stuff comes and goes and comes and goes. And then we hang on to it. We fixate on it. Hang on to it, I don't even mean that we like try to keep it. It's right there, and then that's that thing. And then we've marked it in our mind as that's that thing. And we might even know, well, that's that thing that's here right now, and it's going to be gone in a few seconds. But still, we've marked it as that. Now you're grasping it right there, right in doing that and making that whole intellectual assessment. And so that's what we do. And then it's like, and this is happening, I see this more as an older man. I think I always had this problem, but it really is worse. If I think about anything other than what I'm doing, I could very well forget what I'm doing because that thing just distracted me. I mean, it's really gotten bad. I got to the point where I like sit down on my computer and I'm going to start working and I went, oh yeah, I should really quickly look at my email. And then there's something on the homepage of my browser and it's like, oh, this story about like a long lost John Lennon song or something. Ooh, I'm interested in that. And then I click on that and then suddenly I'm doing all these other things and I really don't remember what I was doing. Yeah. Yeah, and it doesn't even have to be that complicated. It can just be like a thought pops into my head, and then I'm like, why am I sitting here again? Why am I sitting here? It's pretty crazy.
I sat down for a reason.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. But it's really just starting, you know, it's the techniques by which we use to live with that are getting threadbare as you get older, and you just start to realize what you're doing all the time, which is you're always being distracted. That's the only reason that this seems to be not the obvious way. It's because the obvious way is just distraction. It's just getting caught up in our ideas about what's happening. You know, so it does require a little bit of effort not to get caught up in our distractions. But I like how Steve uses this example to help us see there's not a world out there of that car. Because it's a real, you know, one of the things Steve's really brilliant at is just finding a real simple, everyday example. And that's about as simple and everyday as you can get. And then he starts teasing out sound. Where is a sound occurring? And maybe you haven't tried to deconstruct that before. All of you have been doing this for a while, so you may already have been trying to do that. But if you haven't, and then somebody says, where is the sound occurring? And you sit with that, and you try to figure out where the sound is occurring, it actually is not so easy to figure out. And all of our senses can be like that. Some are a little harder to do that with. I think taste, because you know you put something on your tongue, you taste it, so it's a little harder to see that that's you know still that our idea that we're putting this food on our tongue or whatever. We're still doing this thing where there's food and then there's tongue and then there's taste. So we're still kind of creating a world and a separation from us. And the reason I say that is because it's ignoring the totality of everything that's going on at that moment. It's just tongue, food, and it might be yummy or icky, depending on whether we like it or not. But when I had my ear operation, they had to stretch a nerve in my inner ear. And I think they told me in advance, they said, this might affect your sense of taste for a little while. It affected my taste for about 8 months. Yeah. And so I'd taste things, and I remember the first time I tasted them, I went, oh, the doctor told me this is going to happen. Weird. And it actually reminded me of when my mom was going through chemo, and she was trying to describe how flavors were kind of being separated to different parts of her tongue. You know, so rather than like a flavor, she'd eat something she'd normally eat, and said she'd get like sweet and salt. And that's what was happening. So it was like weird texture, and then I could just taste like categories of flavor or whatever. So I realized that nerve that was going in was, you know, communicating information, and my brain was part of what was going on here. And that's just a small part of what I'm trying to say, is there's more to it than tongue and an object of food. Just from that, I started to see the separation in a way that was a little harder to see with taste. But it's easier to see with sight, with sound, with smell. The hardest one is thought. That's why when I had that insight with thought, I said out loud what I was experiencing. It's just because it was like nothing, I didn't even think I'd ever experience it, because it'd be like, well, thinking, you don't think about where thinking is occurring. But if you actually start to pay attention at some point, you will realize you have no idea where this is occurring. Right? And I think I started to get senses of that when I was studying language, and people were just like, well, where's language coming from? I wasn't studying linguistics, but we were just talking about language. And it was, you know, where is this coming from? When I sit down to write a piece of surrealist prose, and it's called automatic writing, and you just put a pen to the page, and then you just listen, and you write down what you're hearing. Where are those words coming from? Exactly. You know, of course, the problem is that question. We want to know, where is that coming from? And we want to locate it. What is, you know, so that, you know, in the 20s, when people were doing that, they thought they were contacting the spirit world, right? So they thought it was spiritual writing, and automatic writing was like, but the surrealists then took that, and they just said, no, it's just language. It's just, language is always flowing. And if we can tap into it and not try to do anything with it, it can actually, for them, it was like, it can open up reality for us. And a way it can do that is by all the ways we box up our experience. They were trying to unbox it for us. So all that weird stuff you're looking at is a little bit like a Buddhist idea. They were trying to unbox your limited way of understanding reality. So you get silly things like a lobster telephone or, you know, whatever things they were doing. But that's really what they were trying to do. They were trying to, like, get you to experience real reality. Surreality, something that was above reality. It was a greater reality, but that greater reality was the real reality, right? So we can do that with all of our senses and realize that we can't locate experience anywhere in particular. And then that idea of self and a world out there starts to soften a little bit, because if we think there's a world out there, then we know that, as Steve puts it, we get jerked around by it, or at least by our thoughts and feelings about it. Because I'm guessing that we probably blame or give credit to the world for our feelings on a daily basis. The traffic, the cat, our partner, politics, our favorite sports team, right? They make me crabby. Or, traffic was great today. The cat's wonderful. My spouse just bought me some chocolates, you know. My favorite sports team's on a winning streak, you know, whatever it is. And we go, la, la, la. Or weather is one of those things. You know, people, it's a sunny day. People are like out and happy and doing things. And then it overcast again. They're like, life is so miserable. And they'll blame it on. They'll go, it's because of the cloudy day. And it might be something about the light and the way that affects mood. I'm not going to deny there's a connection, but that's not how we think of it. That, thinking of that is like starting to think of totality, but just blaming it on the day, you know, or even just being energized by it, even if you're not blaming it. Sunny days are crazy. I used to work in a bookstore. What do you do? Where do you read books? Where do you buy books? Inside. If it was raining outside, nobody'd come to the store. it was bright and sunny, the bookstore would be packed. And it's the same thing with the restaurants. They do worse on bad weather days, which is crazy. Bad weather day is a great time to be inside a restaurant. Otherwise, go outside and fly a kite. You know? So, but when we see the world is out there, then that world becomes the thing that decides how we're feeling, how we're doing, the moral status of the world that we seem to be in, right? We blame it all on that. But we know from these teachings, and again, this is another well-known story, is about Seng San, the fellow who wrote Trusting the Heart Mind. And a monk asked him, "Master, show me the way to liberation." And Seng San replied, "You know this one, who binds you?" And the monk said, "No one binds me." And Seng San said, "Then why do you seek liberation?" So all Seng San was doing was inviting that monk to see the true nature of reality, right there, to pass through. When Ying An says, "No one will pin you down, no one will call you back," he's acknowledging that there's nothing to pin down or call back, just to echo what Andrew was saying before. So he's acknowledging that there's nothing to pin down or call back. There never was, and there never will be. Just as we can't actually place that sound outside anywhere, nothing is actually formed anywhere. If we investigate our direct experience, we'll discover that we can't pin anything down ever, including what we think of as ourselves. Once this moment is seen for what it is, there's no more believing in a universe consisting of a tiny, isolated you that is distantly viewing everything out there. There's no more need to protect and defend yourself against out there or to get, earn, or coax good things from it. This is liberation, enlightenment, freedom of mind. It's the very opposite of resignation. It's the dissolution of the desire to get everything you want or to do whatever you please. You already have the capacity to see truth right now. You don't and can't get this capacity from another, not from me, from this book, from Buddha, or from anything or anyone else. How could you possibly get what you already have? No one can pin you down. No one can call you back. Just as no one binds you, no one blinds you. So, you know, you can't be pinned down because, as Norm would put it, you're unpinned downable, right? Reality is unpinned downable, right? You can't be pinned down because reality can't be pinned down. You can't be brought back because where are you, right? So where are you going to be brought back from? We think, well, be incarcerated again or whatever the case is, but where are you? Once you forget that the self, or I'll re-say that, once you forget the self that is isolated from the world, well, as remember Dogen, the Genjo Koan. So this is the other one with the nested selves in that I was talking about. This is a really famous passage. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all things. To be verified by all things is to let one's body and mind and the bodies and minds of others drop off. All traces of enlightenment come to rest, and this rest carries on without end. That does not sound like resignation to me. It's vital. It is alive. It is, as Katagiri described it, the vigor of a fish leaping out of water. It is true freedom. Freedom, Steve says, from our desires. So these teachings bring us back to reality. But remember, this all comes from Four Noble Truths. Second Noble Truth. To be free from our desires. And you have the capacity. That's what all of these teachings help you to see. You have the capacity right here, right now to do that. I would say it's why you're at Sesshin. And not, you know, it could be you're there trying to get to that gateless gate. But if you actually start seeing what's going on in Sesshin, you can see when you're engaging with this moment and when you're not. And when you're not, It's as if you're waiting for someone else to take care of it for you, right? And you can see that here in Sesshin. It gives you the opportunity. It's long enough that all the gizmos that you use to try to get your way through it, they're going to just not work. And you're going to be stuck with it, looking at what it is that's showing up. You can see in Sesshin how it is that we get bound and how we overlook the self that can't be pinned down or can't be brought back. So, that's that one. Do you have comments or questions? Observations?
This really melted well with Jen's talk on the Heart Sutra yesterday. This points directly to liberation and Heart Sutra and our Zen practice.
Yeah.
It's like you guys planned.
Yeah, absolutely. And I liked how Jen was pointing out too that the perfection of wisdom isn't a thing, right? That it's you know, we make it a thing and then it's something out there. All right, but if we realize it's just right here, that's the liberation, and that's what the Heart Sutra does with all those negations. You know, it's just getting rid of our conception, our conceptualizations, our ways of constructing the world, and not that, not that, not that. Thich Nhat Hanh has a fairly new book about the Heart Sutra, and in it, he said those teachings, the way that's translated, he goes, it's so confusing. I'm going to come up with my own version, and I wish I could remember what it is because it's interesting. What he says is very interesting, and he just tries to get rid of know this, know that, because people get really confused about it. But if you know what the know is pointing out, right, which is just again the way we construct the world, you know, the way we think of me and the world outside, and then those, you know, you get to the 18 data or whatever those are, you know, where we're looking at eyes, nose, and we're looking at sight, and we're looking at consciousnesses and all that stuff. That's classic Buddhist psychology, and it's just negating all of it because it's really helping us to see that's still just a structure that's being used to kind of help direct us back to the actual experience. So yeah, you're right. This is very much at the heart of what Jed was talking about.
What was the name of the piece in Steve's book? Was it True Freedom?
What was it?
The piece that you were talking about today, was it True Freedom?
True Freedom, yeah.
Just when you first started out and you said you were gonna talk about that and you said the title, I could feel tears coming into my eyes. I mean, there's something so and I think you do a great job with this I'm trying to think of the right verb here. I'm bringing up over and over again that this is possible. That this is possible for us. That encouragement is really helpful. So thank you.
Yeah. And it is. That is what's great about this teaching is that this is not, it's so accessible, you know. Anyone could do this really. But you have to have the patience. So I say anybody could do it, but I also know it's not for everybody. So. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.